This evening, as we begin, I know we've got, some of you have books, some of you are sharing books. The reason I put this one here is I just remembered that somebody's already paid for it, and they're not here this evening, but we will order more if we need to. If you need one, you'd like one, please let me know. We can have them here in a couple of days. But the world in which we live is a scary place. I think we all would agree to that. Especially these days, with poverty, with hatred, with wars, with abuse, with all kinds of things that not only we see on the news and we face, and natural disasters and other things, but especially for children. Imagine when we were growing up. I want you to take a moment to think about what are the top five things that frighten you about the world today for children. Let's try and come up with at least five things. And they may be even different from what was going on back when we were growing up.
Drugs.
Do what?
Gangs.
Abduction.
Sexual predators, abductions.
Them being involved in sexual activity.
Children being involved in sexual activity. Got some interesting insight on that. Internet. Not only predators, but other things on the internet that children get to that perhaps they shouldn't. Society questioning God.
And it's not even, how about even the other religions and some of their agendas?
Okay. I can think of a couple of which you might be thinking. And the abuses in those religions, especially since Quran says that religion is never to be forced or coerced, and violence is only to be used in defense when attacked. But and we could come up with more. I said five. We've got a whole bunch here. We got more than five. And can you remember anyone when you grew up? Now, I already know the answer in Piedmont because there was one key that fit every house, so there was no need to lock the door. But growing up, Carrie said they never locked the doors. We rarely locked the doors. You certainly didn't lock the doors of your car.
And we were never at home. We got up in the morning, we were gone, and we didn't come back till sun went down.
Right. How is this list perhaps different from when we grew up? I've already mentioned one. You didn't lock the doors. You didn't worry about people coming in and taking what you had.
No internet.
No internet.
Parents
taught the morals.
Well, Karen and I were talking. We never saw drugs in school. Really,
until
we hit college.
Yeah. In high school, I didn't see drugs in school. I knew of folks that started the funny weed. You knew your neighbor, and these days, a lot of times, you don't. That's right, Al. Right. Well, we walked to school, which was a little over a mile away, or rode your bike, and you didn't worry about what was going on. I do remember the one time that I got mad at my mother and I hid under a couch, and they went all up and down the street looking for me, and all the trouble I got into back then. I really don't have. Let me go get some water on this. And I will tell this story on my brother and my mother. My mother got all upset at my middle brother, Mark, because he disappeared for about 3 hours one day, and she finally found him when he got back. He had gone up and down the street door to door selling vanilla wafers for 2 cents a piece out of a box. And she was mad, not because you didn't tell her where he was going, but because everybody might think we were really poor. What kind of parent is that that sends a child out sell vanilla wafers for 2 cents a piece?
Sell them too cheap.
Okay, so there are all kinds of things. Do what? I'm struggling right now, yeah. Well, that's what happens when you got a three-legged easel, but only one chain. Fear of diseases, and now we don't worry so much about polio as we do other kinds of diseases, HIV and hepatitis B and C and all kinds of other things, and new strains of superbugs and things like that. So,
the churches that everybody went to,
right. For celebrating and for doing these other things, right?
Bible, I mean, you know.
Yeah. Well, and you encounter that. You encounter the world, and I know a couple of years ago we did a brief survey of world religions, but I tell folks the world is here. There are Hindu, there are Vedic shrines in the upstate. There are Shinto shrines in the upstate. That's Japanese. There are Buddhist temples, and there's a Buddhist monastery, Khmer Buddhist monastery, outside of Duncan Lyman, Welford area. There are Islamic masjids. There's one on Wade Hampton Boulevard in Taylor's within spitting distance, though I wouldn't do that if anybody was watching, within spitting distance of a little Christian church, right? A little Christian church sitting right there next to it. There are Baha'i centers, the Sikh Center of South Carolina, which is the guys in the turbans. The Sikh Center of South Carolina is located less than a mile from the subdivision where Stephen and Lynn live between Peak and Valentine. South Carolina, and on we could go. And so you run into those as well as Christian denominations and other things out there as well.
Oh.
Yep. Well, and that used to go on, and it still does go on in some places. But so the world is different. It's very different. It's very much more close than sometimes we would like. Well, yeah. Other kids are running all over the place. That's right, Maxie. And she holds your hand. That's just like Sydney. You know, we get out of the vehicle, first thing is hang on to the hand and that kind of thing. That's true. And we're here, at least in part, I hope, to try and talk about how to make the world a better place, especially for children. Not just ours, but for all children. And part of doing that, I think, is to understand some of what children are going through, what they're facing, and then trying to identify ways to make the world better. The introduction in the book begins with a story from the Wizard of Oz, and where after Dorothy and Toto end up, you know, she gets knocked out, but they land in Oz, and she starts looking around, suddenly says, you know, we're not in Kansas anymore, Toto. Well, we're not in Kansas, even though we may never have been. We're not in Kansas anymore. We're not in, you know, because, you know, we think of Kansas, especially traditionally, as a place of values and morals and niceties and all those kinds of things. We think of earlier days, even around here, when we didn't worry about so much about which we worry today. There are dramatic changes that have taken place. And near the bottom of the first page of the intro, there's a quote from Margaret Brodkin. American children are more likely to be poor, drug dependent, pregnant, murdered, or incarcerated than children in any other industrialized country. What? No, wait a minute. We're the U.S. But it's true. When the book was written, the stats on page 4 said the U.S. was first in teen pregnancy and in children killed by guns annually. That hasn't changed a whole lot, folks, other than except for maybe Thailand, where little girls are are used as sex slaves. 3 million children were reported as abused in the mid-90s. 1 in 5 children was hungry. There were 100,000 homeless children in the United States. Over 15 million children lived below the poverty line, and 10 million children were without health care. Now, it's gotten better, right? 2010 census stats. 34% of all children in the United States are in single-family households. 42% of the children in South Carolina are. Every 10 seconds, a report of child abuse is made. 2011, according to a government report, more than 5 children die every day from child abuse, and 80% of these are under 4 years of age. 60% of those on the death certificate, they don't report that it's a result of child abuse. They put down some other cause. Approximately 30% of abused children and neglected children will later abuse their own children. I remember a commercial some years ago that had a man who walked into a jail cell. It closed behind him. He turned around, put his hands on it, and the tagline was, "This is the face of an abused child and a child abuser." 80% of 21-year-olds who were abused as children met the criteria in 2010 for at least one psychological disorder. 14% of men in prison in the United States and 36% of women in prison were abused children as they were growing up. Homelessness in 2010, and homelessness is defined by the government as sharing housing of others due to the loss of housing, economic hardship. Number two, living in motels, hotels, trailer parks, campgrounds because of lack of alternatives. Number three, living in emergency shelters. Number four, abandoned in hospitals. 5, awaiting foster care. And 6, living in cars, public parks, public spaces, abandoned buildings, bus or train stations. In 2010, 1.6 million children were known to be living in those conditions as homeless in the United States. Homeless children are 2 times more likely to be hungry. 1/3 are forced to skip meals on any given day. They're 2 times more likely to repeat grades or be suspended or expelled, and only 25% of them will graduate from high school. 2009, 21% of all children 0 to 17 years old live below the poverty line in the U.S. That is 15.5 million children. 2010, 15.1% of all people in the U.S. live below the poverty line, which was the highest since 1993, and 22%, or 16.4 million children, lived in poverty in 2010. In January 2012, the best estimates are that there are 8 million children under the age of 18 with absolutely no access to health care whatsoever. Those are some pretty sobering statistics, and we'll find out more as we go along through some of the other chapters on family life and abuse and violence and those kinds of things. So what are we to do? What does the Bible say about these issues? Proverbs chapter 31, verses 8 and 9. The Bible says that we should speak out for those who cannot speak, for the rights of all the destitute and poor. Speak out. Judge righteously, defend the needs of the poor and the needy. In Isaiah chapter 1, we find that the prophet, in speaking on behalf of God, verse 17 says, "Wash yourselves, make yourselves clean, verse 16, "Wash yourselves, make yourselves clean, remove the evil of your doings before my eyes. Cease to do evil," verse 17, "learn to do good, seek justice, rescue the oppressed, defend the orphan, plead for the widow." Once again, and these are not things, problems that we have just today. These are issues, obviously, that have occurred throughout history. But today there seems to be such a laissez-faire kind of attitude of so many people towards the plight of the poor and especially children until we hear of some tragedy close by or we see it on the news. In Jeremiah chapter 5, verses 28 and 29. They have grown fat and sleek. They know no limits in deeds of wickedness. They do not judge with justice the cause of the orphan to make it prosper, and they do not defend the rights of the needy. Shall I not punish them for these things, says the Lord, and shall I not bring retribution on a nation such as this? A nation that doesn't care for its children, that doesn't watch out for the needs of the poor, but especially the needs of children. We could go to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and find many places where Jesus speaks of children. But in Mark chapter 9, verses 36 and 37, then he took a little child and put it among them, and taking it in his arms, he said to them, whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me welcomes not me, but the one who sent me. I'm not even going to look up James 1:27, because James 1:27 is James' definition of true religion, in which he says, true religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this, that you visit widows and orphans in their affliction while keeping yourself unstained from the world. Caring for widows and orphans, but especially those orphans, and not just orphans, but children as a whole, while keeping ourselves unstained from the world. The way that we can really help children and others is, first of all, to keep ourselves in proper relationship with God. And then we can truly pass that along to children and others. Micah, I didn't put this down, but Micah 6:8, do justice, love kindness, walk humbly with your God. Acts of charity, ensuring fairness for children, recognizing who we all are before God, especially children. And the opportunities. You know, I'm 60 years old. I hope I've got a lot more life left, but I've lived a lot of my life. Yes, I've had privileges that others have not, and I've had others who've had more privilege than I in different areas. But I was brought up in a home where God was worshipped, where church was important, and where the care of not only each other, but neighbors. We knew that if we acted up at one of my neighbor's houses, their mama was going to treat us just like my mama would. And if they were at my house, my mama was going to treat them the same way. We did that too with ours. You know, I mean, Stephen's best friend, Shane Litton, knows. There was more than one time that I had a talking to him and sat him in the backyard in different corners of the fence until we got things straightened out. You know, there was that whole idea. But it wasn't done in a judgmental way, although sometimes it was done at the end of a switch. But there was that general sense, that connection. And why did we do it? Why did my parents do it? Our neighbor's parents do it? Why did we do it? Because we cared about those children. Not just ours, but the children with whom they played, the children with whom they grew up. And their families cared for ours. Interestingly enough, in the Chronicle of Higher Education, August 26, 2011, and talking about the generation that we call the millennials, giving a little bit, that's people born after 81, a little bit of description, said they grew up in a child-centered culture and received a great deal of attention and consequently expect feedback. Digital technology has always been a part of their lives. Millennials are accustomed to working in groups. Oftentimes, they're accepting of diversity. However, millennials need more social and group-oriented atmospheres to keep them from falling through the cracks. And that's where some of the groups, some of the things you listed here, gangs and other things, are scary. for our children and for our world's children. So what are some of the things that we as parents, grandparents, and friends initially can do? Each of these chapters, by the way, talks about statistics and gives stories about situations in which our world finds itself, our country finds itself, our children and grandchildren and friends' children find themselves. And then there's a section, so what can we do as parents? What can we do as concerned persons, I would say? And I listed some here. Some of these are in the book and some are not. And I want some of your feedback too, but how do we welcome and care for children? First of all, be a parent, not their friend. I heard a guy talking not too long ago. He said, well, what I told my children was, when they said, you're just mean, you're not like my friend's parents, they're their buddies. So I looked at him and said, that's okay, I'll be your buddy and your friend when you get to be 30. But right now, I'm the parent. Set structure. Be the parent, not just the friend. Because oftentimes, friends don't do that. They don't set structure. And so be the parent. Not mean-hearted or mean-spirited, but set the structure. Some of the children that come here on Wednesday nights obviously don't have a whole lot of structure at home, do they? And sometimes they have trouble with the limited structure that they run into here. And I say limited, I know there's structure, but I also know that some of your homes and some of your children and growing up, just like ours, were a little more structured than what even they get here. But you can only go so far. You don't want to turn them off. But set that, quite frankly, they need the structure. They need to know that there are boundaries, or else we're going to find their name in the paper concerning drug use or child abuse or gang-related issues, etc. So be the parent, not the friend. Communicate with children. How often? I won't ask how often. Anybody in here that always gives full attention to their child, much less somebody else's child? I didn't raise my hand either. But children do pick up when you're not giving them your attention. As much as possible, if you give them full attention, that says you're important to me, and they're much more likely to listen. Much more likely to listen. Even when you correct, they're much more likely to listen. Welcome them. That acknowledges their presence. I've said over and over again, and I fully believe it, that the opposite of love is not hate. The opposite of love is indifference. If you love somebody, you're going to tell them, you're going to let them know, and they're going to experience that. If you hate them, you're going to let them know. Most people will, right? One way or another. But to be totally apathetic and indifferent says you're not even worthy of hatred, much less love. You're not worth anything. Acknowledge. They're important. Teach the value of hard work. I know nobody in here has ever spoiled their children, and they sure don't spoil their grandchildren. But, you know, but what are the things that you appreciate the most? Carrie?
Effort.
The things that you gain by effort, by doing hard work. Teach the value of hard work. Do not reward mediocrity. And yes, this is my little facetious statement. Oh, you made the CR roll? Wow, here's $25. Don't push mediocrity. Don't reward mediocrity. Expect more. Now, there are limits, and you know your children, and you know your grandchildren, and you know your friends' children, to the point where you know that there are limits of expectation. If that's God, tell Roy I'll talk to him later. Or Dean. Sorry. Teach the value of work, not mediocrity. You know, celebrate and recognize their successes, but their successes for hard work. The children that come around here on Wednesdays, don't just praise them because they don't talk out of turn all the time, but praise them when they do something that is good. You know, one of the things that I kind of goes all the way back to when the first time that Mary and I and the boys and I went, not the first time we went back to Connecticut, but the first time we went back to Connecticut to visit her family, when her nephew, Colin, was finally old enough and started playing T-ball. And they got out there, and every inning, everybody batted, everybody got the score, and nobody kept score. I said, wait a minute. My boys didn't understand it either because I created sports monsters. When they were in Little League and I was coaching, I taught the kids how to break up a double play at second base. And when they got on first and I was the coach, I said, I expect you to break up the double play at second base. Now, competition. But reward the hard work that they do. Don't just reward them because they showed up. And that's what was going on there. Celebrate and recognize the successes, especially for hard work, because that builds confidence, that builds self-esteem. And some of the children that with whom we deal don't get that at home very much from what we see, do they? Work for justice. Flip over. Work for justice and do acts of kindness. Doing acts of kindness tends to do what? Create acts of kindness in others. That's right. That's right, Francis. We do acts of kindness to someone, it tends to then get them to do something else. Have y'all noticed the commercials? Some of the commercials are really inane, but have you noticed the commercials that kind of have that idea? Somebody holds the door for somebody and there's somebody else that sees it, and so another person drops something and they rush over and pick it up and give it to them, and somebody else sees that and they do it. Doing those kinds of things, and especially with children, younger children, can do it with older, but by the time they reach middle school and high school, a lot of things have already been set within them. It's much more difficult. But starting younger, pre-memory time, starting younger, doing those kinds of things and teaching the value of acts of kindness. Not only are we fulfilling biblical instructions, but it teaches children to treat others this way. Do unto others as you would have others do unto you. There are far too many cases in the world today where it seems the attitude is do unto somebody else before they do it to you. And not in a positive way, but in a negative way. Of course, one of the things that we want to do when we see the scary world out there, what do we want to do for our children? Hide them. Protect them. And we need to do that in a limited way. We need to give exposure to things in appropriate ways. But we really do our children a disservice, our children, our grandchildren, if we keep them hidden away in an ivory tower. Now, that doesn't always mean that we're going to have the easy answers and they say, Mommy or Daddy or Grandma, why are they doing that and I can't? Well, then that's an opportunity to teach. But don't keep them locked away in an ivory tower. Help them learn the realities of life, but help them learn those appropriately at an appropriate age, and let them know. It's not, and somewhere else in here, don't tell them they're a bad child. They may have done a bad thing, or they may have done an incorrect thing, but don't tell them they're a bad child. Don't tell them they're a lazy child, because what does that do? Right? It reinforces it. It makes them be that way. And the children want to be confirmed, do they not? They want to be paid attention to. They want to be confirmed. And if the only way they get confirmed is through bad, sloppy, lazy behavior, then what are they going to do to get your attention? Yes, bad, sloppy, lazy behavior. And what that does then, if they do that and they know they're going to get the attention from you, even if it's negative feedback, at least they're getting attention. The likelihood is that when they get out away from you, they're going to be doing the same kinds of things. And that can, it doesn't always have to be, but that can be that old slippery slope that people are so fearful about. and be a family of faith together. A family of faith together. Be a faithful mentor for faith. Some are very good at being families of faith, away from the church and even at home. The ghost. But model that faith. Model that faith with children, especially with those children who don't come from a faith-filled family situation. Children on Wednesday nights. I know sometimes you want to pull your hair out. Sometimes just being in the same room with some of them 5 minutes, and I'm saying, okay, is there a coat rack around here somewhere? And it takes a great deal of patience and a great deal of faith. But remember, we never, ever know. I still remember, I wasn't around when it happened, but I remember seeing a newspaper clipping back early last century. And it was a picture of feet. And it says, who knows where these feet might have gone if someone had taken the time to nurture. And you look in the fine print and there's a picture of the feet of John Dillinger. You never know what you may say will go one way or the other. Young Chinese man who was interested in politics and interested in this curious thing called Christianity. Started going to a church in China. Wondered about this philosophy and this Jesus that they were talking about. Wondered about how this church worked and functioned. And one Sunday after church, there was going to be a business meeting. And everyone was told, if you're not a member here, you need to get up and leave. Well, he got up and moved to the back and just kind of stood in the back, wanted to see what happened. And then when he refused to leave, he was forcibly ejected. I think I've used this example before somewhere else, but I'll ask in a moment if anybody knows who it was. Later on, he rose to power, but that day he swore that he would do everything he could against the Christian church and against Christianity. Yes. You spoke that just properly. She said, Mao Zedong. That's how she spoke. No, Mao Zedong. Chairman Mao. Don't know if he ever would have become a Christian, but once again, the way he was treated set him against Christianity in the Western world and the Western church. What are some other ways that we can welcome children and help children? And that's a part of it, Paige. Giving of the time lets them know they're important. Give time and give attention lets them know that they are important. What are some of the ways that, moving ahead then, what are some of the ways that family life has changed? The Cleavers don't live here anymore.
Mothers work. There's not always mother, daddy, and children.
Okay. That's right, Francis. Mothers work, not always mothers, daddies, and children at home.
Children are involved in a lot more.
Yeah, children are involved in a lot more things, a lot more activities.
Children are being pushed into a lot of activities.
Children, that's true, Hazel. Children, in some instances, in many instances, are being pushed into those kinds of things when they may not necessarily want to be there.
Family time.
Right. That tends to be less family time.
Yeah, I mean, we've gone on, I guess, inverse before we started the last century and we're back to it now, where a work week was more than 40 hours, then it got to 40 hours, and now we're back to being more than 40 hours instead.
Yeah, a lot of folks do work many more than 40 hours. On page 31 of the book, there's a quote from LBJ about the importance of the family. The family is the cornerstone of our society. More than any other force, it shapes the attitude, the hopes, the ambitions, and the values of the child. And when the family collapses, it is the children that are usually damaged. when it happens on a massive scale, the community itself is crippled. And the family collapses. In infancy up to about age 5 or 6, from that point, those are among the most formative years, not only in language and learning, but in values. In values. In the development of values. Can go a little bit further along sometimes, but by the time children get to late elementary and early middle school, if those values have not been built in, who becomes the most important shaper? That's right, peers. Teachers can have, depending on the situation, probably more so in a private school than otherwise, Al. But, Paige, you're right, peers. Peers. Wearing the same kinds of clothes. Getting all those Hello Kitty clothes. Or getting the right clothes. The right music. The right hairstyle. All those kinds of things. Peers become more important. A child is much more likely to stay closer to tradition and understanding of morals if they have had those shape them in younger years by family. Not just mothers and fathers, but siblings and grandparents and other family friends, than if they don't get that at a young age. They're much more likely to get involved in other things that are not beneficial for them and for society if they do not have that early on. And we see it sometimes in children in which we encounter, not just sometimes here but in other places, who are from families that seem so disconnected. It's much more difficult sometimes to get those children to settle down and to even begin to understand why they should act a certain way and why the moral should be a certain way. When families are strong, stable, and loving, children have a sound basis for becoming caring and competent. Adolescents and adults. There are all kinds of things, and I know that there are all kinds of reasons for marriages to end. But one of the things that you'll find in the book as you read is one of the things that has help to create more difficulties for a lot of children. It's the rise in the divorce rate. And then the rise in single-parent households. 1 in 2 in marriages in the United States ended in divorce these days. And don't think about religious folks being so much better. Shared this not long ago with some. The latest stats say 1 in every 2.5 Baptist marriages end in divorce. And clergy aren't much better. The stats say 1 in every 2.5 to 3 marriages end in divorce for a variety of reasons. U.S. divorce rate is among the highest in the world. After 5 years, it became the highest. In about 5 or 6 years ago, U.S. had dropped to number 12 in the world, but now divorce after 5 years of marriage is the highest in the entire world, in the United States. And it affects all kinds of things. It affects worker productivity, lost days at work, increased medical costs, but it especially affects family structures, children, and extended family. As of 2008, the U.S. had more single-parent households than any other developed country in the world. And the highest percentage of households with children in single-parent situations. In 2010, 84% of all custodial parents are mothers. Though of all children in the U.S., 60% lived with two married parents. But in 1980, that was 80%.
Among the wealthiest nations in the world.
Yes, we are among the wealthiest.
We have the most freedom than any other country in the world.
Right. Well,
you can't communicate.
No, and that's the big thing is communication. Although there are other, I mean, some of the things we listed here, violence, hatred, other things contribute to those. And abuse, not just child abuse, but abuse of spouses contributes to that. But, yeah, we, 23% of children in 2010, 23% of children who live in single parent homes live with the mother only. Excuse me, 23% of children live with a mother only in the U.S., 3% with a father only, and 4% with neither. Of that 4%, 54% live with grandparents, 21% with other relatives, and 24% with non-relatives. 4% of all children in the U.S. live with two unmarried parents in the household. 20% of children with fathers only are living in situations where there's cohabitation. 10% of children with mothers only is cohabitation. I know this didn't used to be. The psychologist said no, but currently the latest studies indicate that folks who cohabitate for a period of time, for at least a year prior to getting married, are significantly more likely to get divorced after they get married than those who don't cohabitate. You know, back last, I remember 60s, 70s, and 80s, you know, psychologists saying, oh, it's better to go ahead and cohabitate and get used to each other, and then you might stay married longer. That's not the case. That's not the case. In 2010, 34% of children in the U.S. lived in a single-parent household. In South Carolina, 42% of children in South Carolina currently live in a single-parent household. The family is the single most influential factor in a child's physical, emotional, social, moral, and religious development. In 1995, 60% of children living with the mother only were near the poverty line. In 1998, 45% of children were being raised by a divorced mother, and 69% were never married mothers near the poverty line. This is in the poverty line. I don't have Greenville County stats. I did, but I didn't write them down. I was looking at stats the other day. Ethnicity groups also are much more affected. Different ethnicity groups. What do these kinds of things then contribute to? In 2004, 75% of the children or adolescents in hospital for chemical dependency came from single-parent homes. Over 50% of youth in jail facilities for criminal acts were from single-parent homes. 63% of suicides among children. So it is a situation that is very dire.
Those statistics really go back to the statistics that we heard from missionaries and whatever about the 1 out of 5
making. Well, it is a similar kind of, yeah.
If it's the parents, then it's the kids too.
Well,
1 out of 5 homes.
That's true. But it doesn't mean that single parents are bad people. It just means that they're facing much more difficulties of being a single parent and of trying to raise children in those kinds of household situations. One of the leading psychologists a couple of years ago said that one of the largest challenges and concerns in the United States is the lack of fathers involved in children's lives, fatherlessness. So there are those effects. They affect the children, but then they also affect the parents because the parents oftentimes don't know what to do and how to be parent as well as provider, etc. It's very, very difficult on the parents as well as the children. Latchkey kids, that's a term that started around World War II. according to in the book, the figures are from the mid-90s. 2010 census, U.S. census, 33% of all school-aged children are latchkey for some part of the week. That means they come home to an empty house or an apartment. That's 5 to 7 million children between the ages of 5 and 13. Marion Wright Edelman of the Children's Defense Fund estimates that it's closer to 16 million if you factor in children up to 15 years old. Census Bureau says of these, 15% are home alone before school, 76% after school, and 9% spend the night at home alone because the parents are working the third shift. 50% of all children aged 12 to 14 are home alone 7 or more hours per week. The National Safe Kids campaign recommends that no child under age 12 be left at home alone, although you need to consider both the age and maturity level. Lynn Yaney for the agency handling child welfare in Contra Costa, California. A general rule of thumb is that kids under age 7 aren't capable of thinking logically and putting cause and effect together. They're relying on caregivers to structure their day. Again, there's structure that we can offer to structure their day. Children between ages 7 and 10 aren't generally ready to self-supervise for an extended period. But in a routine and predictable environment, such as just after school, they can manage. Children 12 and 13 should be judged on a case-by-case basis, but no child under 13 should be left alone overnight. There are moves towards age restrictions. South Carolina has no restriction on age when you can leave a child at home alone. North Carolina is not much better. It's 8 years old.
8 years
old. You can't leave one under eight, but 8 years old is the limit, is the level, which raises concerns, right? Anybody want an 8-year-old child at home alone in your house?
15-year-old on my house.
The girls at work, a couple of years ago, we set up a program for them to bring kids and take them to the movies. Some of us would take them just to keep them out of the home by themselves. There was that many.
Well, and there are other stats. 51% of those who stay home alone regularly that are reported child welfare agencies are doing poorly in school. And most teachers, according to a national survey, said that being home alone is the number one cause of failure in school. Afternoon hours are the peak time for juvenile crime. Since 2000, juvenile crime during the day has increased by 48% in the United States. Eighth graders who are alone 10 to 11 hours a week are twice as likely to abuse drugs than those who are busy after school. Teens who have sex generally do this in the afternoon at the homes of boys whose parents work. Unsupervised children are more likely to become depressed, smoke cigarettes and marijuana, and drink. And latchkey kids are more likely to be victims of crime from their friends, their siblings. But a bigger concern is outsiders who know that they're home alone. There are many things that we can do in addition to being available. I want to talk some more, and I know I've run way over tonight. I want to talk some more next time and read this chapter and go into chapter 2. But some of the things, there are not only, there are volunteer grandmothers and grandfathers. You volunteer to give a phone number to families around so that when children get home, they can call. If they can't call a parent, they can call you as a grandma or grandpa figure and let you know they're at home. If they get scared, to let you know they're scared, that kind of thing. So at least there's somebody with whom to touch base. Don't do everything for the kids, but teach them how to be safe. The key, though, is... One last story, and we're going to go on this. And I don't want to leave so much on a down note, but I want you to think about some ways. I want to list on the board next time some things we can do as individuals, as a church, as a community, to help with this kind of situation, especially with children being home alone. But I shared with some of you a few weeks ago about getting out at Publix, getting out of the car, going inside to get something, and as I walked by, no, excuse me, Bilo, so I walked by this vehicle, big SUV, in front of me, I noticed that it was running, and so I turned and looked, and there was a small child asleep in a car seat inside the vehicle with the vehicle running. I walked into the Bilo, I looked around, I got my stuff, I came back out. 10 minutes later, the car was still running, the child was still asleep. Well, about that time, I walked around back and I looked at the license tag number and I stepped back to my car and I pulled out the phone, and by the time I went to turn it on, out walks the mother, puts 3 bags of groceries in there, gets in the car and backs up and drives off. The car was running. The keys in the car, I thought. Who could snatch that child? It got worse. I went to the Wally World. This is in Taylor's. Across the road to the Wally World, pulled into a parking space, started down the aisle and looked, and guess what? That SUV was sitting there running, and the mama wasn't in it, and the child was still in the seat. About the time I walked in the door and was going to go get one of the managers, I saw the mother coming out with 1 bag of groceries, and I watched her as she headed back and got in the vehicle. Should I have turned her in? Maybe. I don't know. But one of the things is, too, is to be responsible parents and grandparents and friends, to learn responsible action so that we don't leave these children alone like this. The Bible says, what is true religion? To care for widows and orphans in their affliction while keeping yourself unstained from the world. Widows and orphans represented the most vulnerable in society. That's our children. Our friends' children. The children that come here on Wednesday night. The children we see on the street corner as we leave. The most vulnerable in society. That is the future. Not only of our country, but of our world. And I hope that we can find ways to start, yeah, small. We can't do it for everybody, but to start with our own children, to start with the children on Wednesday nights, to start with children in our neighborhoods, to start making even more of a difference, and not just kind of looking and they're just figures out here that we see dimly and darkly, but paying significant attention to who they are and where they are and how scared they might be. God bless you. Go in peace. I look forward to seeing you next Sunday night. We'll talk some more about this chapter, and I hope you've got more to say than I do next time. I appreciate the input tonight. And then we'll move to chapter 2 on violence as well. Thank you. Good night.